to welcome you all on behalf of the Graduate and Faculty Christian Fellowship. We are delighted to see so many people here. And I'd just like to briefly introduce the context of the Graduate and Faculty Christian Forum, which has been in existence on the campus for about 27 years, and which is a forum designed to explore the interface between faith and scholarship. And we are funded by the President's Office, by a committee which is called the Murrin Committee. And this Murrin Committee funds a number of different activities, both of Christian, Jewish, Muslim, and other faiths. And we have been fortunate in receiving support from that committee for a number of years. Now, I can't imagine a more relevant topic than that which we are going to be considering this afternoon. And those of you who still read newspapers will note that every single day there is some aspect of this issue brought to our attention. So I'm honored to introduce Benjamin Perrin, who is Associate Professor in the Faculty of Law at this university. And he's also a senior fellow of the MacDonald Laurier Institute for Public Policy. He's one of Canada's leading authorities on human trafficking and the author of Invisible Chains, Canada's Underground World of Human Trafficking, which is a Penguin publication, 2011, and which was named one of the top books of the year by the Globe and Mail. Professor Perrin has served as special advisor in the office of the Prime Minister and senior policy advisor to the Minister of Citizenship and Immigration, and the United States State Department has recognized him as a hero, acting to end modern-day slavery. He received a BCom from the University of Calgary in 2001, a JD from the University of Toronto in 2003, Master of Laws with honors from McGill University in 2007. He was called to the bar in Ontario in 2007 and to the bar in British Columbia in 2010. Professor Perrin is internationally recognized researcher and advocate for victims of crime. The Governor General of Canada and victims groups have also recognized him for his work to combat human trafficking and child sexual exploitation. Professor Perrin is the recipient of the Wilson Pritchard Award for Community and Professional Service from the University of Toronto. He's co-editor of Human Trafficking, Exploring the International Nature, Concerns and Complexities for the CBC Press, 2012, and editor of Modern Warfare, Armed Groups, Private Militaries, Humanitarian Organizations, and the Law. And this is published by UBC Press in 2012. He's also the author of numerous law review articles and book chapters, and regularly provides commentary in the media. Prior to joining UBC, he was a law clerk at the Supreme Court of Canada, a judicial intern at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, to The Hague. He was assistant director of the Special Court for Sierra Leone Legal Clinic, which assisted the trial and appeals chambers, senior policy advisor to the Minister of Citizenship and Immigration, and executive director of a non-governmental organization that combats human trafficking. We could not be in the presence of a more distinguished colleague in this area. He will speak to us on confronting modern day slavery, human trafficking in Canada. Professor Perrin.
Thank you all so much for coming today. I have not heard all those things strung together ever. And it makes me feel exhausted, quite frankly. Again, due for my sabbatical next year, now I know why. But no, really, only my mother knew all of those things about me until now, so now all of you do too. Very generous introduction. Thank you so much for having me join you here today. I know that a number of you are regular participants in this series. There's a number of others that I'm sure you'll hear about after from board. This is my first time here, so I'm really excited to get connected with this group as a Christian and a law professor. And for those of you who are here out of interest in the topic alone, I hope you'll find that really interesting and engaging. So today's talk is going to be primarily about a number of studies and a major research project that I completed several years ago now. And the reason that I'm continuing to talk about it is because still it comes as a shock to many Canadians. And it also has some very important contemporary implications, including if we want to get into the discussion period with respect to the recent changes to Canada's prostitution laws in the wake of a Supreme Court decision last year and the public debate that's surrounding that right now. So this is an ongoing issue, and what I'm going to do today is introduce you to the topic the way that I was really introduced to it, starting very briefly at the international level and then bringing it very, very, very close to home, including to cases right here in Vancouver. And we're going to have a lot of time, I hope, for the questions and discussion that we'll have. So to start with, I always like to start presentations on this topic, not with the sort of me as a talking head, but with the chance for you to actually get a bit of a sense of what the issue is all about. There's a very compelling documentary that the U.S. State Department helped support. I've got a very short clip from that I'm going to show you. It's about 8 minutes long. And it will introduce human trafficking to you, not through the words of just experts and people who research it, but through the words of those who are victims and survivors of human trafficking. And these are international cases, so probably ones that you'd be more familiar with when you hear this topic. There's also a case in the United States you're going to hear from a victim there, and then I'll bring it home to Canada. You're also going to hear from some traffickers, which is a very rare opportunity to actually hear directly from the words of people who are directly responsible for this horrendous human rights violation. And so as you're watching this footage, it is disturbing. You're going to hear people describe in their own words what happened to them. It's very horrific abuse that was visited on them. And it's important to remember, and this is one of the really important things that I learned very early on since I first started working on this issue overseas almost 15 years ago now, is that the people who you're going to see are not defined by that abuse. These are people who we now call survivors. They've received substantial support and counseling, and they've chosen to tell their stories so that others would be able to understand and learn from them. So I'll show that to you, and then we'll come back together, and I'll begin the presentation for today.
This phenomenon of modern-day slavery, I'm convinced, exists in every country of the world, including the United States of America.
Trafficking in human beings is not mainly for sexual exploitation, but for labor, for begging, for organs, for adoption. There are all kinds of exploitation. Because of their vulnerability, they easily get into these kinds of situations without knowing.
I see me in a mirror, you know, and I don't know, I say, it's not me. I don't know, I can't believe it, I do that.
Traffickers send you
told the parents and asked them if they would be willing to hand him their daughter because he could provide for her a better life.
Nu mă simt, nu. Deci am fost la până înțelege, eu mă duceam poate, erau familii care erau mamă și fică. Și mă duceam la femeia lor, care erau amărâți. Și mi-am zis, nu e decât să stați amuzuriți, să cerciți sau să, eu știu, mă, să furați, să dați în cap.
You can't explain it away by saying, well, some country has such desperate economic circumstances that, that parents allow their children to work to make more money. Or that culturally, it's a natural thing in some countries for a child to be sent to another family to work as a domestic servant and then get enslaved. There's no excuse for that.
You do have mainly girls trafficked from four regions of the country. But the main reason is the dysfunctional family, and we're talking the psychological reasons why a girl will end up in a predicament like this.
My family, it was drinking, you know, and the people who don't like to work for something. I have four brothers.
She was basically dropped by her parents in an orphanage. She was disposed of.
I was alone and missing the love, the affection.
She ended up as a victim of traffic because of the corruption within the system. It was a leakage, someone kicked the traffickers, and that very night the traffickers showed up at her door, broke the door, kidnapped her and her friend, kept them locked for that night, and then shipped them over in Hungary the second day.
When I was in Albania, I heard about special, some kind of training facility, you know, in the countryside, nearby big, big cities in Albania. And the girls were, you know, brought from abroad, trained there, then to be sent to the market in Italy mainly, but also to other countries in Europe. And the kind of stories you could hear was, you know, execution of one girl to show to the other ones that they don't have to move. And either shot or burned.
Every time when I say no, I don't want to do that. I don't want. You can beat me, you can do anything you want. He beat me so much, he's missing one teeth. And I was pregnant.
I remember several times I have seen, you know, young girls with their breasts all burnt because of cigarettes. I have seen and I have met women that they were shot on the streets, and one of the girls, I remember, she became paralyzed.
Ma non mi ha detto tante volte che se provo a scappare, se provo a fare qualcosa di male, o se mi beccano mi sparano o va a picchiare mia famiglia. Sì.
Nu știu, părerea că toată viața o stresă cu coșmarul ăsta. Și vezi unde mai reușe să se schimbe, dar nu s-a mai putut să fie femeie normală niciodată.
I can tell you that in the United States, we're confronted with a situation now where thousands of kids are being trafficked from state to state and throughout our country.
All I know is about the truckers, and out of a truck stop that's got 50 trucks in it, you're probably going to get 46 of them that want you to come. I mean, being 13, I didn't really know what I was supposed to be doing. All I know is what I was told to do. Day in, day out. I probably met about 30, 40 truckers there. More likely, maybe even more. I really try not to keep count.
She was forced to perform different sex acts on these men for different prices. And at the end of the night and turn her money over, all of her money, to this individual?
We jumped a fence. That's really hard to do in high heels. We're walking around. There's lots of semis, and there's also a lot of girls out there, and a lot of them are just, they look like half our age. They look like they could be like 8 or 9 years old.
You know, Angie's not any different than anyone else's child. She wants love. She wanted to feel some sense of security, and she didn't get that in her opinion, and made a terrible mistake.
We get in the first truck, and the guy decides he wants me, so I go back there, and you know, I just have to just pray to God, just please help me, just please let me get through it, you know. Melissa threw the wallet. And he had a grandkid as old as us. All I can think about the whole time is how my grandpa could be this guy right now. And how that would feel. And I just wanted to die.
So I didn't think it could happen in Canada. When I was overseas in Cambodia, working on this issue in 2001, the only Canadian connection that we were aware of were that there were Canadian men, pedophiles going to Cambodia and abusing kids there. And it was sort of atrocious to see Western tourists doing that. But we never realized that it was happening in our own country. And it wasn't until I was a law student, one of the reasons I went to law school was because of this issue, because I couldn't understand how something like this could happen in this day and age. Then I got a call from the Calgary Herald. I grew up in Calgary. And I thought they were going to ask me about one of our cases we were working on in Cambodia or overseas or something else. And they said, no, it's a local case. I said, what do you mean local? They said, it's actually here in Calgary. And this is a case that the Calgary police identified. They gave it the code name Operation Relaxation. And it was a series of massage parlors throughout the city that they had got an anonymous tip about, that were bringing women from Southeast Asia to Canada, and they were being sold, literally being sold, like slaves, to people who wanted to start their own massage parlors. And these women would have to work off inflated debts, just like you see in countries around the world, debt bondage. Until that was paid off, they would not be allowed to go. They would be charged rent, charged for days they would be unwilling to provide sex acts to men in the city. And the Calgary police went undercover, posing as members of a massage parlor who wanted to buy women. They were even given tips on how to control them. This is back in the early 2000s, and at the time there was no offense of human trafficking in Canada. Why? It couldn't happen here, right? Similarly, there were no measures in place to help and support victims. And so what happened in the aftermath of that case really appalled me. The traffickers were convicted of money or prostitution-related offense and were sentenced to pay a fine of $10,000. That's it. They're estimated to have made several, the numbers never really got pinned down, but in the ballpark of a quarter, they're at least $500,000, probably a lot more. So $10,000 is a little bit like a cost of doing business. And more egregiously than that, the victims of these traffickers, there were believed to be about 46 of them. Some of them vanished because of the raids that occurred. The others that were in the massage parlors at the time of these raids were arrested, locked up, and because they were from abroad and here in Canada illegally, and engaged in an illegal practice, they were deported. So they were locked up in immigration detention and sent back to their home countries, never to be heard from again. And we still don't know what would have happened to them when they were sent back. So this got me as a young law student quite aggravated. Here I was trying to call up countries like Cambodia for doing things that were a little bit like this, and here it was happening in Canada. And so it started out as a small project with a group of law students. We found a number of organizations had been calling for Canada to do more. Turned out Canada had signed an international treaty back in 2000 that committed us to creating an offense of trafficking, to creating some measures to protect victims, to give foreign victims some temporary immigration status and access to health care counseling. And Canada had done none of that. So we put together a report, a sort of name and shame report, maybe this was an early indication of my inclinations to be a professor. We graded the countries and gave them marks. Canada got an F. My students will tell you I don't give many of those ever. It's not fun. But this one, it was well-deserved F. And lo and behold, it was when the new government had just come into power in 2006. And so I got a phone call, and basically they were, what are you doing saying we're the bad guys here? You know, we don't know what's going on. We've only been in office for like 8 weeks. I said, well, here's a quick thing you can fix. And if you remember, some of you back to 2006, after the federal election, 2006-2007, that time period, the new government got elected based on a very simple platform. Remember the GST used to be 7%? Do you remember that? So they had this commitment, they got to lower it to 6 to 5. They had like three priorities, and everyone was all excited about it, who voted for them. And so that's what the government had said they were only going to do. Nothing else until those were done. And so here we are coming in with some new issue. So talk about pushing a boulder up a hill. And I said, I really don't care. This is something that's an horrible injustice, and you've got to deal with it. And this is the only time I've ever heard of where you get a job from criticizing someone, but this is how I got that policy advisor job. They said, you seem to know something about immigration. And I said, well, maybe a little bit, but not a heck of a lot. And literally from the report being released in February to May 1st or so was when the immigration minister then was literally, I was so happy I got to hand him the pen and he signed off on what became today a series of temporary resident permits for trafficking victims. And so there were a lot of people behind this. And for years, groups had called for this. We were not the first or the only. But it was an example of, for me, I can say, very, very, very clearly feeling moved and directed to do that work. That it was at the right place at the right time. And we had just barely enough skills as law students to put something like that together. So I always encourage my law students, and there's a number of students in here today, don't wait until you've become whatever profession you're going to do to start trying to have a positive impact. Do it now. I have students who are doing research papers that they get a good mark on and the paper goes in the recycle bin, and others who now are writing these papers for other purposes. So they get the mark, but then they go and hand it to the government or organization. And so just a really strong source of encouragement for you to follow your skills. So that was, I thought, an isolated case. I didn't think there would be a lot more. I thought we'd probably find a handful of these types of cases. And when I started here at UBC in 2007, so just a year or so after that series of TRPs came in, I thought someone should really go and research this. And so that's what I did. So I spent 3 years traveling across Canada, meeting with and interviewing people, yet doing access to information requests, going through report filings, trying to piece together what was really going on in our country and how were there other big gaps in our response. And so what I'm going to do with you is walk through some of those findings. And I'm going to start with the first case. This is Emeni Nekpangi, who's a courtroom sketch of him. He is Canada's first convicted human trafficker. And every one of the cases that I began to learn about broke the mold and the assumptions that I had about trafficking. First, I thought it could only happen abroad. Then I thought it could only happen in Canada if it was maybe foreigners and probably only the sex trade. This case really shocked me, and it shocked, I think it's fair to say, the judge and the lawyers that were involved. Emeni Nekpangi recruited two young women in Canada, and these are Canadian girls. So the victims are Canadian and the offender is Canadian, and the exploitation happened exclusively in Canada. Now, how is that trafficking? Well, trafficking is not about moving people across international borders. We have migrant smuggling laws that deal with that. What we're concerned with when we talk about trafficking is treating people like property. So trafficking drugs, trafficking weapons. We don't ask how far these things have moved. We are concerned with them trading hands, for example, between people, right? And so the way that human trafficking is defined in international law is that it's the use of force, fraud, or coercion to cause someone to engage in either sexual exploitation and prostitution, forced labor, or in some cases, organ removal. And in Canada, the criminal code talks about it in a slightly different way, but just to give a very clear definition for you, it's a trafficker, someone who essentially causes someone to provide labor or service. It's very broadly defined, so it can include anything, out of a reasonable fear for their safety. So it can include threats, it can include psychological harm, it can include deception. The point is that someone is in control of this other human being and they're exploiting them. And that's why this is referred to as modern day slavery. And so Nekpangi is very interesting because he also shows us an example of how one person
can simultaneously use two totally different methods to control young girls. The first victim that Nekpangi exploits, that we're aware of at least in this case, we give her the name of Eve, coincidentally because she's the first human trafficking victim that we have in Canada. So no one's really picked up on why we name these things that, but some people in this room might have clued into that. So she was 15 years old and homeless. So start to think as I'm going through these cases, in your own mind, of a sort of list of risks, okay, and why, how could these people come into these circumstances? She was essentially traded to Nekpangi from another person who had begun what we would have called back then pimping her out. She was probably sold to Nekpangi. The Crown could never figure that out. From her perspective, all she can say is, one day I was with this man, the next day I'm told Nekpangi is now your boss, right? Just like if you were a piece of property or a piece of cattle. If you sell a dog, they don't know what the transaction was. And I'm using crass language because that's how these people think of these young women. What Nekpangi did is he tattooed his name on the back of her neck. He branded her. And when I heard this, I thought, this is a sensational detail, which we'll tell when we talk about the case, but surely it doesn't happen often. If you go on the internet and Google trafficking victim tattoo, you're going to find reams of articles, and it has happened around the world and across Canada and the United States. And some of them are professional tattoos, and many of them are not. And they are horrific brands, like you would have seen in historic slavery. So she's branded with his name. He physically assaults her and threatens her that if she doesn't pay off what he said was her debt of between $100,000 and $150,000, that only after then would this 15-year-old Canadian homeless girl be allowed to be freed from him. So he began advertising her on Craigslist and selling her at a hotel and motel rooms in the greater Toronto area for 2.5 years. Now, at some point along the way, he realized that he could make a lot more money if he had more than one girl working for him. And so rather than likely go and buy one from another pimp, he decides he's going to try to recruit one on his own. And so what he does is he finds out where the local children's aid societies have their shelters. And he finds this 14-year-old girl who we call Samantha. She has fetal alcohol syndrome. So again, think of this list of risk factors. People go, how could you not just leave? How could you get sucked in? There's no one in this room who is homeless with fetal alcohol syndrome who's 14 right now. So it's very hard for us to associate with this, right? Nekpangi starts going around, and what we've been told from the police in this area is that the most common thing that traffickers do to try to lure in these young girls is they don't come on with the physical violence. They convince them that they're the knight in shining armor. They're the boyfriend. And the smallest possible signs of affection are enough. So taking her to a fancy dinner at McDonald's. Those two words have never gone together for anyone in the room before, have they? A fancy dinner at McDonald's, okay? Opening the door for her, which no one has ever done. Most of these young women did not have a father in their life, and if they did, the father was physically and sexually abusive of them. This is the first male person they've seen who shows them any whiff of what they think is love and affection, and they latch onto them. After a while, he suggests to her that they could make some money, that he's got some money he's got to repay to people, if she would simply sleep with his friend. That's always how it starts. The friend thinks she's beautiful. He won't consider it cheating, and he'll even pay them. It turns out it's a lot of money. $300 for half an hour is how much he sells her for. And so once she's done that once, he says, we should just keep doing it, and goes from there. So he's simultaneously selling Samantha and Eve on Craigslist, and over this period of time, he makes, according to the court record, over $360,000. This guy's really smart. There's a lot of people in this room with a lot of degrees. This guy is smarter than any of us at making money. He's done it in a horrifically evil way, but he has figured it out. He's making more money than he would have from drug trafficking or weapons trafficking. He is at a far lower risk of detection. Okay? Drug sniffer dogs can't detect human trafficking victims, right? They're hard to detect, and as I told you previously, till 2005, it wasn't even a crime to do this. What happens then is he's charged with human trafficking, and he's charged with prostitution-related offenses. Now remember a minute ago I told you the criminal code definition is causing someone to provide a labor service out of a fear for their safety. Only one of these two girls feared for her safety. Samantha. He used the violence against her. Eve. Samantha, this girl with fetal alcohol syndrome, who he befriends and thinks she's in love with, he never assaults her or threatens her or anything. He doesn't have to.
She is, quote unquote, willingly doing this, and I think we'd all understand that that's not actually something you'd say is voluntary in any real meaningful sense of that word. But she is not, in Canadian law, a human trafficking victim. And so she is someone who is considered in law a prostitute, and we used to have laws that would deal with that, and now we have some new laws to deal with it. And so he is convicted. Now, fortunately, because of, I think, the egregiousness of this crime, he is given at least a jail term. Now, that may surprise you that I'm even happy about that, because what we found after this case is a series of other cases where traffickers were convicted. One in Montreal, which really stood out for me as a real flashpoint, a man who was convicted for trafficking a 17-year-old Canadian girl, sort of similar circumstances to this boyfriend type recruitments, but then he turns violent on her when she tries to leave. And he's convicted for human trafficking and sentenced to just 2 years in jail. But because he'd spent a year in pretrial custody, he got his 2-for-1 credit back then and was given basically a week in jail to kind of wrap up his affairs. And so no wonder the victim in that case had absolutely no interest in giving a victim impact statement. And the Crown agreed with this. The Crown defense both came forward saying, yeah, we think 2 years is good. So he's going to walk out the door. So as I was doing this research and meeting we interviewed the police officers who investigated these cases. In some cases, we were able to meet with victims. And we began to put together a broader picture and realize that, in fact, this was far more diverse than we really initially realized. This is the impact that, just to give you a glimpse into it, from what Eve had to say in the Nekpangi case. Again, she's the one who was 15 and homeless and he physically assaulted repeatedly. She said, I'm constantly looking over my shoulder, afraid either Imani or his friends are going to come after me for putting him in jail. I don't feel safe at home. He knows where I live and what my family looks like and where they live. I have nightmares about him. I have low self-esteem. I don't know why someone, a man, would be interested in me and to try to get to know me because I feel unworthy, dirty, tainted, nothing. Basically lost 2.5 to 3 years of my life being with Imani. Well, I mentioned before there was nothing really in place for foreign victims of trafficking in Canada. Well, turns out that's the same and was the same with Canadian victims. Now, you're all thinking about the healthcare system and that. Well, if you're not registered and you're not paying your premiums in provinces that require it, you're not going to go in and get free healthcare. If you don't have an employer who has a dental plan, you're not going to get your teeth fixed. This girl missed all of her high school. She was branded with his name. And she walks away. He's going to jail for 5 years. And what does she do now? She was homeless before. So the police did something that I've never seen another police force replicate. They built this cocoon around this young girl. They've got all the services that she would need. It's not the job of the police to do this. They found a volunteer tattoo artist who would help to conceal the name of her trafficker in this beautiful floral design. And I've seen the photos of it. It's absolutely beautiful. And subsequently, other victims of trafficking have taken on that same design. It's a lotus flower. And it's a symbol for them because it grows in this mucky, turbid water, but when it blooms, it's absolutely wonderful. So she's moved on with her life. She's moved far, far away from him with some relatives, and from what I've heard, is doing really well. The same cannot be said, though, of Samantha. The officer who was responsible for this case asked her what she got out of it other than having to sleep with random men. And her reply was, I get respect. I get respect. That's the mind game, says Constable Arnold. He respected her. She never got that from her parents. If you can believe it, Samantha bought his lie that he was her knight in shining armor so much that while he was in jail, she continued to prostitute herself as a minor, trying to get enough money because she didn't understand how the legal system worked. She thought she could get enough money to get him out on bail. And what did he do with all that money? Well, it turns out he did, in fact, have a partner down in Niagara Falls. And he used it to buy luxury automobiles, apartments, that kind of thing. And what we found in our research was few, if any, cases involving trafficking involved the seizure and forfeiture of those properties in that. And so when I started asking why was that not happening, what I heard from it, at least in some jurisdictions, and it's not the case, as I understand here in BC, but it was the case for quite some time in Quebec, is that there was no, and this is how it was put to me by a police officer, a senior investigator,
There is no money for us in human trafficking cases. What does that mean? A portion of their budget, the police budget, for these vice units, comes from, or came from at least in that province, the seizure and sale of assets from the cases that they successfully closed. So with drug cases, they do what they do in the United States. If you're a drug trafficker and you use a vehicle to move the drugs, the vehicle's seized and sold at auction. If you used a condominium to store them for any period of time, seized and sold. And they'll go all the way up the chain as far as they can to get the luxury yachts from the proceeds. That money from these seizures for drug seizures was going into police budgets. So they had an incentive to go after drug cases. But because trafficking convictions were so rare and difficult to get, victims are often intimidated or sometimes recant, much like you see in domestic abuse scenarios, we did not see the money coming in. And so this huge disincentive to go after cases involving the exploitation of people and preferring the other forms of the criminal code was causing some real serious problems. So that's just to give you a glimpse into one case in a bit of detail. I want to go through some high-level findings now with you and hopefully broaden your mind, if you haven't been exposed to this issue yet, about how diverse it actually is in Canada, because I was shocked when we got into these cases to find out what was really happening. So first off, it is national in scope. We found cases across the country, not just in big cities, but in smaller towns and communities. It's not just sex trafficking, that's what you hear about most of the time, but forced labor as well, and I'll tell you a bit more about that in a second. As you've heard, the victims are Canadians. They're also newcomers. There's adults and children, women and men, male trafficking victims. And I'm going to tell you about a case involving the largest human trafficking bust in Canadian history, and involves men who are victims. And the estimates, because this is considered a sort of dark figure, statisticians have had a heck of a problem in any country trying to nail it down, but we were quite confident to say, based on the confirmed cases we identified, that we've got at least hundreds, if not thousands, of victims being exploited in Canada every year. Now, with respect to foreign sex trafficking, what we found is cases, and this is not one or two cases, many cases, occurring in the entire range of what you would refer to as indoor prostitution venues. Okay? Now, there's an overlap between prostitution and human trafficking, and there's a debate about this. I'll just put on the table, when I'm using the terms, what I mean. When I'm talking about prostitution, I'm referring to the exchange of consideration, often money, but sometimes drugs or even food, for a sex act. That's what I'm referring to as prostitution. Trafficking, again, is that definition I mentioned before. In the case of sex trafficking, it's the sex act is being provided out of a reasonable fear for the safety of that person, right? Or through force or coercion or some other form of deception. Okay? So with an act of prostitution, there's the what you would refer to colloquially as the John and the prostitute. With trafficking, there's a third person in the picture, as I understand it and the way the law understands it, who is in charge and controlling the victim. So prostitution is an area, like other areas where you've got vulnerable people, that's ripe for human traffickers. So it creates what the U.S. State Department has called an enabling environment for human trafficking, and also because there's a lot of money in it. So we found trafficking victims in cases in what are called micro brothels. This is the new way that prostitution happens in the Lower Mainland for at least a decade. It's not on the street. You will still find street prostitutes throughout the Lower Mainland in certain areas, absolutely. But street prostitution in Canada is estimated to be around 5 to 10% of all prostitution. So it literally is the smallest tip of the iceberg. Micro brothels are high-end condos often, or apartment buildings, and there's frequently networks of them. So these women are kept moving through them. And the way that the Johns find them is there's obviously no signs. Think of any condominium you've ever lived in. There very well could have been a micro brothel in there. They're advertising these young women on the internet. And it used to primarily be through Craigslist. And so technology is connecting the purchaser and the seller in real time, and it's at that moment that they're told on the way what the address is. And before the day is done or the week is out, that victim has moved to another location. So you can imagine detection becomes very difficult. And for the police to track a person, right? It's not just this is being used for prostitution, but there's actually a trafficking victim here. Escort agencies is another one, so pretending to be some sort of quasi-legitimate industry. The idea behind an escort agency as well is that culturally, Many people believe that women who are escorts are doing so as consenting adults, and that this gives a veneer of legitimacy, or that it's somehow not immoral. Like, people might see street prostitution as being more of a survival sex thing. So we've seen the escort agencies being used. Massage parlors, I've already mentioned one case. There's many others. Strip clubs, one of the access to information requests we got, we received information from the Canada Revenue Agency, who was responsible for reviewing some contracts that were being proposed for foreign women to come to Canada and be in strip clubs. And what those contracts included was, and this is the language of the CRA, so federal bureaucrats, not known for their flourishing language, said the contracts smacked of slavery. That was the language from that report. And of course, advertising online. Wherever, whenever you are in Canada, men are able to, and women, but primarily men, 99% or so of sex buyers are men, are able to purchase a sex act wherever they go. And what I used to do in my presentations when I released my book is I would go on Craigslist the night before or the morning of, and I would simply pull up for their city, what was then called the erotic services section, and I would post an ad on screen without any revealing photos or anything, just to show them what's happening in their community. And this is a tactic that they've used in the United States to convince people this is actually going on. And it didn't take me long to find photos of girls who clearly looked, they're all fully clothed here, they looked like they were clearly underage, and this was happening right in their community that morning, right? And so it was a bit of an eye-opener, because this is not something that you're going to see on the street corner as much anymore as you would have maybe 20 or 30 years ago. Now, with respect to foreign labor trafficking, this is one of the victims of what's referred to as the Domator criminal organization. Domator is the name of the main offender. There were dozens of people part of this Central and Eastern European loosely affiliated organized crime syndicate. And what their idea was is they were going to bring men, like this man who spoke to the Globe and Mail and allowed his photo to be shown, they'd bring them to Canada to work. So this is the deception. We're going to bring you here to work. What happened, though, is they did things like seize their passports, forced them to sleep in storage rooms. They would not allow them to leave. They mistreated them. They fed them food scraps. And eventually what happened, the police found out, is the traffickers not only were benefiting from their labor, they were working on construction sites in Hamilton day in and day out, but they were then also claiming welfare benefits for these guys. And all the money was going to the traffickers. So think about that for a second. You got one victim and you got two revenue streams. You heard it in a business background, so I tried to break this down a bit. Very brilliant, right? So they're getting money from the federal government and the provincial government at the same time that they're extracting the labor from these people without their benefiting from it. And so I tried to find the exact number of the latest number of confirmed victims in these cases. I couldn't last night. It's around three dozen men from mainly from Hungary and some from Romania. And so eventually one of them came forward to their local embassy or consulate and was able to blow the lid off this whole thing. And many of the traffickers were convicted and sent to prison and then deported. And so what we tend to find is what the International Labour Organization has said internationally, which is where you're going to find forced labor is in sectors of the economy that are 3D. This is not like fancy new movies with those glasses. Dirty, difficult, and dangerous. This is where you're going to find labor trafficking cases. So agriculture, construction, cleaning, domestic work, hospitality. We found forced labor cases in all of these sectors here in Canada. With respect to domestic sex trafficking, we found the victims were as young as 13 years of age. These are Canadian victims exploited in Canada. They were targeted at group homes. Aboriginal youth shelters. These are where traffickers are looking for these people. Centers for abused women. And to blow another myth out of the water, not all traffickers are men. Laura Emerson is the first convicted female trafficker, and she was in Ottawa, and she went into a center for abused women, posing herself as an abused woman and befriending these people, making them think that she was like one of them, and then getting them addicted to substances and then forcing them to be sold for sex. And when one of them tried to flee in the frigid winter air in Ottawa, and she tried to flee into the Ottawa River, Emerson dragged her out by her hair and threw her back in the car and then beat her. And she was convicted of human trafficking, and she had her Cadillac Escalade seized and
some of the money was taken as well. So you're starting to see the police are beginning to view in many parts of Canada these cases much differently than they did. Back when that Kennedy came forward, the judge said, where's the cargo container? It's a human trafficking case. Where's the cargo container? Like in The Wire, or it's not like Taken or these Hollywood movies. It looks different. Walking home, there's an area in Winnipeg on the sort of wrong side of the tracks where young Aboriginal kids get propositioned by traffickers. At high schools, we had a high school in North Vancouver just several years ago where recent graduates, so the young men, would come back. They're the kind of cool guys. And they would begin inviting the younger girls to house parties. And that's where drugs get offered. And the next thing you know, they're selling these girls for sex acts again on the internet. Shopping malls. The Winnipeg was a great example for this. Anyone here from Manitoba or Winnipeg? No? Okay. They have a really, the shopping mall. Okay, the shopping mall. It's not like we have a few. They've got like one big shopping mall. And that's where everyone from outside of Winnipeg wants to go. So all the kids have come in. They're visiting friends, they're from many of them from off reserve, and the social workers that I went to this mall with would tell me, they're like, we could spot in a second who the people are who are new to Winnipeg. It's not hard to tell. They don't have the same types of clothing, they don't have the nice shoes, and that traffickers are able to do the same thing. So they basically hang out at shopping malls and find these kids coming in and befriend them. And in one of the cases that we found, a really potentially tragic case, a number of young Aboriginal girls were told by these young guys that they befriended, we're going to go to a house party in Saskatchewan. Think about that for a second. We're just going to go tonight to Saskatchewan for a party. Sure, sounds good. Okay, none of us are going to buy that one. It's like, hey, let's go to Edmonton for a house party tonight. Does anyone want to get in the car? So they did, and they were wards of the province, so they were reported missing, but nothing happened. And this is going to start sounding familiar because some of this links in to the issue of murdered and missing Aboriginal women in all likelihood. And the police actually at one point pulled them over, but didn't have the connection between them being reported missing and somehow let them continue on. And it was only at the hotel when they realized what was going to happen that one of them literally ran out of the hotel room naked and a security guard saw her and it helped them get out before anything far worse happened to them. They were recruited in that manner. Bus stations, parks, and Facebook. We have a case in BC as well, a number of cases in Canada where Facebook has been used by traffickers. They pose as really cool guys or into maybe it's hip-hop or R&B or something that's going to get young girls talking to them, and then it turns into some real-world contact. Young girls running away from home, 16-year-old girl in the interior agreed to meet a man she met online. Turned out he was on probation for assaulting prostitutes, and he got her to come to Victoria. He paid for the bus ticket, and he met her on Facebook. So the other side to this is Jesse Foster, that is very alarming to me, is not only are Canadians being exploited in Canada, but they're also being exploited in the United States. Jesse Foster has been missing now for several years. Her mother, Glendine Brandt, has launched a tireless campaign to try to raise awareness and has hired private investigators and everything to find her. And from what has been publicly disclosed about the case, Jesse was involved with some people who turned out to be pretty bad characters, and one day simply vanished in Las Vegas. She's disappeared and was believed to have been was being sold as a prostitute in Las Vegas. And so we still don't know what happened to her, but we do know from the RCMP reports is that Canadian women have become trafficked to the United States. According to the RCMP, $10,000 is the going rate for Canadian women. Think about that. That's how much you're worth. $10,000 a weekend. That's the price on your head. There's a dollar value associated with a human being, and that's what it is. And it's not pretty. This is from a police incident report that we obtained, and it describes it in pretty clinical language. It says the victim was lured from Edmonton to Las Vegas, raped and beaten, then flown to Fort Lauderdale, Florida, raped and beaten again, and then forced into prostitution. Now, the other side that you often won't hear about is the demand side. And none of this would exist without the demand in the case of sex trafficking for commercial sex acts. And it wouldn't occur in forced labor without the demand that all of us, unfortunately, have for cheap products and cheap labor. And I would be absolutely shocked if someone in the room did not, in fact, have in their home, in their vehicle, in their cell phone, some product or some ingredient to that product that was, in fact, made with forced labor. It was unbelievable for me to hear about some of this from experts who do forced labor trafficking research.
It's been one of the reasons that the state of California now has a law requiring supply transparency so that companies have to track where the rubber comes from. And so if you're concerned about this sort of thing, the US Department of Labor publishes a list of the top products for forced labor. I have it in my book. And there are things, if you're buying cocoa or rubber, or which is your tires and your car, right? You need to know where it's from, because if you don't, you're being willfully blind, essentially, to the potential that was made with forced labor, because these are huge markets. In the case of sex trafficking, and this is where we get back to the prostitution issue a little bit, what the research has shown is that men who are seeking to pay for a sex act don't know or don't care if the person is a victim of trafficking. When they're in the room at that point, they're thinking of one thing and one thing only. And so we have not come across cases where Johns are reporting victims of human trafficking. This is just not happening. And so you think back to Many Neck Pangi, there were literally thousands of men who paid for sex with them. And they actually kept a logbook. Why would they do that? They kept the phone numbers of the men and the sex acts and the amounts of money. The reason they did that is because they were told, Samantha was told, sorry, Eve rather, I'm supposed to make $100,000. So she started keeping track. That's how much you say, Nick Pangi, I'm going to keep track. The police have that logbook. Not a single person has ever been convicted for that. And that is an offense. It's a mandatory term of imprisonment for having engaging in a commercial sex act with a minor in Canada. But not a single one of those men has been prosecuted. And I've made the point before, and I've made the point in Vancouver here, including to the police and the media. If you watch the evening news tonight, and I encourage you to do this over the next few weeks, you will see every single type of criminal or accused criminal named. Arsonists, rapists, thefts. The animal cruelty is in the news, right? All of these people are named prior to conviction, okay? Prior to conviction. You will never in this city read a newspaper naming a John, ever. Why is that? Why is that? Why do we have one category of criminal offender who is protected with anonymity? That says a lot about this issue, I think. Next up, I'll come back to Sweden potentially, but we can talk more about demand if you'd like. There's a few more pieces I want to put up for you. And I'll wrap up in just a second here. This is something that really got my attention as well as we're doing the research. We're finding these cases are starting to accumulate. And at one point, the police said to me, well, these traffickers are just figuring it out on their own. And I said, what do you mean by that? They've got playbooks. And I was like, come again. They've got playbook, like written like a football team would have a playbook. They're like, yeah, would you like to know what they are? So I asked them, and they referred me to one of them. And they said, when we execute search warrants at traffickers' homes, we find two things. We find a copy of this book, or one of the similar books that are out there. And we find, invariably, numerous seasons of The Wire. Has anyone seen that show? It's a really great show. It's an HBO show. It's about wiretaps and the police and all this. And it's semi-authentic. And so they're watching The Wire because they want to learn how to avoid being wiretapped by the police. It's like buying burner cell phones and stuff. So this is what the traffickers have. They've got The Wire in these playbooks. I'm going to show you just an excerpt. This is like a 200-page book. This is an excerpt which describes the ultimate process that traffickers, many of them use, to groom their victims. And I'm going to warn you, the language is quite offensive and crass, and it's important you see it, I think, because this is what they're reading and what they're doing to people in Canada. It's from a book called The Pimp Game, and you can see there's even a Kindle edition. This is being sold on Amazon. It's not some secret book. It was on Amazon. Here's just an excerpt. You'll start to dress her, think for her, own her. If you and your victim are sexually active, slow it down. After sex, take her shopping for one item. Hair and or nails is fine. She'll develop a feeling of accomplishment. The shopping after a month will be replaced with cash. The lovemaking turns into raw sex. She'll start to crave the intimacy and be willing to get back into your good graces. After you've broken her spirit, she has no sense of self-value. Now, pimp, put a price tag on the item you've manufactured. I've described this as it's like a recipe for exploitation. And you can see the language of slavery in there. You own this person, you've manufactured them, put a price on them and sell them. And this is exactly what's happening. So, for your own interest, whenever we see stuff like this, like Craigslist being used, these books, we try to get these companies that are facilitating this to do something about it. You can imagine a terrorist manual describing how you do that. You wouldn't want to have that. Manuals on how to commit murder, probably wouldn't want that on Amazon. Why is this on there, right? So eventually it got pulled after enough groups wrote in and protested, and I was pretty happy about that until I realized that the reason it got pulled is because a new edition had come out. This is how Amazon.com, this is from a couple years ago, this is how Amazon.com describes the next edition of this book by Mickey Royal, who wrote this, who's a self-proclaimed pimp. Amazon describes it as, quote, a smart, engaging, and eminently entertaining account of how to establish an organized stable of prostitutes run with the efficiency of a Fortune 500 company. This is this is appalling. And so how do we possibly come up against this as a society? It's really a huge, huge battle. Here are the three main ways that the response to trafficking is typically framed, and we can talk about this more if you like more detail on any of them. There's really three things that you need to do. One is obviously, and the biggest thing is prevention. So how do you do prevention both with all those young women and those men who are lured and sucked into this? How do you do that? What are the ways that you can effectively intervene and target your intervention to prevent this crime, both in all its forms? Protection is another one. What are the services and support you're going to need once that victim is able to be free from the grips of her trafficker? What do you need to have in place? Here in BC, we have a governmental agency that does coordinate services. It has some challenges and problems, but we are at least fortunate to have something like that here. There's a victim hotline that victims can call or agencies can call. We can talk more about how that has worked or not worked over the years. And at the sort of tip of the spear here is the prosecution piece. And it may surprise you to hear there's a whole bunch of people who don't think we should prosecute traffickers. And the reason for this was when trafficking first became a major issue in 2000, many countries took it as an opportunity just to crack down on illegal immigration primarily. And so it was seen as being harmful to the victims, and you had cases like the one in Calgary where the victims were treated like criminals. So people said, well, if you're going to just do that, why are you going after the traffickers? I've never bought this argument that it's an either or. We absolutely have to hold these traffickers accountable. Serious jail time, taking the proceeds, major conditions when they're released. And the victims need help to become survivors. And in many provinces, that is still quite lacking. So what is some of the success? These are some of the things that here at UBC we've had a small role in playing. I've had a group of, I'd say, about probably 60 or 70 students over the years work on this project. And together with them and other organizations, we've contributed, not on our own, but contributed to a number of things. One is Canada now has a national action plan on human trafficking. This was the top recommendation coming out of the book Invisible Chains that I wrote with their assistance. And it brought forward recommendations, many of which were adopted and some of which weren't. So if you're interested in that, that report is online. It's a government report, which I was really happy was adopted a few months after I moved into the Prime Minister's office, so that was great. We helped change laws. Remember I told you about how that one trafficker in Montreal had to spend just a week in jail? Well, we brought in a private member's bill through Joy Smith, who you can see in the bottom right. Just announced she's retiring from Parliament. It was the first private member's bill to pass in years, and it amended the criminal code to put in a 5-year minimum penalty for child trafficking, and it goes up to much higher, it goes up to life if there are serious aggravating circumstances. And that's been in place, and traffickers have been convicted under it, including here in Vancouver. Craigslist. We were part of the campaign in Canada to have Craigslist get rid of its erotic services page, where it was freely advertising, and I've got charts and stats I can show you of how rampant Craigslist was. Just absolutely rampant. And what the police told me was the main conduit for trafficking to be advertised. With the support of, I think at one point, we had 6 provincial attorneys general calling for Craigslist to crack down. And then the federal justice minister, they finally shut that down. But literally what we did is when my book came out, I said, I'm not doing a book tour, I'm going to do an awareness campaign. I'm not really concerned about selling a book that we're going to be giving proceeds to people for. Instead, I want change to happen. So what we did is I'd show up in a province that morning, and then all day they'd be doing interviews in radio and TV and whatever. And I had usually 1 or 2 goals in each province, and it was always to get that local government, the justice minister typically, to come out publicly and say that Craigslist wasn't welcome to sell children or trafficking victims in their province anymore. And typically by the end of the day, so by the news, evening news, they had the camera in front of the justice minister, and they were, we're going to do this. There wasn't, we're going to look into it. We're doing it. We've sent the letter. It's already done. And by the time this campaign ended in Ottawa, like I say, there were six provincial attorney general who had taken that on. And then the federal justice minister was completely on board. And so it was not a problem. It took a lot of work, though. We had to, at one point, we threatened Craigslist with launching a private criminal prosecution against them because they were knowingly aiding and abetting the sale of minors in prostitution. And if any of you know much about that, that would have been a huge uphill battle, but there was enough to it that they took it seriously. That, by the way, was after about 12 to 14 months of trying to cooperatively work with them, and they weren't taking any action. The other things that we were able to do is a lot of training for police, Crown, and judges. This is the role of other people to do, primarily, but we've done some of it. Community engagement is another one, public awareness and media. And then what this has really come full circle to now is, what do people who are concerned about human trafficking have to say about the issue of prostitution in the wake of the Supreme Court of Canada striking down our prostitution laws? Because as you've heard through the talk, these two are very closely linked. And the changes to our prostitution laws absolutely have an impact on our ability to fight human trafficking. So I'm going to end there. I want to leave you with a bit of a sign of hope. It is a very, very serious issue. It is a horrific thing that's happening in our country, but there is progress being made. And for any of you who are concerned about this and want to learn more, I would definitely encourage you to take a look at the book that we wrote, to take a look at the online resources. And one of the things that I have is a list of organizations that are actively working here in BC on this issue. And if you could donate time or money, the shelters for trafficking victims need clothing and baby toys. The need is endless. Please feel free to let me know. So I'll leave my contact information up here. And if you do email me, let me know you're here today so I can link you up. And the other thing I'll just mention is, for those of you who are interested in hearing more of a faith-based perspective on this, I'm going to be speaking at this really great conference that the UBC Christian Law students are putting on this weekend at 3:00 at the law school. And I'll be talking specifically from a more biblical and faith-based perspective about how, as a Christian and a believer, I've come to understand this issue and what I think additionally can be done from those people who are of faith. So if you're interested in hearing more about that, I definitely would encourage you to come. So thank you very much. I'd love to hear from all of you.